In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show, helping you get a little more intelligence on big government. On today's show, we're going to talk about the ongoing battle of urban versus rural, and something Oregonians know about all too well, the effect of one giant black hole of a population center that often outweighs and outvotes the rest of the state. Although in this case, we're not talking about what's happening in Oregon. Instead, we'll be talking about the ghost of Oregon's future, New York State, which, sadly, is where Oregon and other states like it will be headed if we don't take actions now to prevent it. Longtime listeners of iSpy know that I'm not a native Oregonian. As I like to say, I wasn't lucky enough to have been born an Oregonian, but I was born to be an Oregonian. Instead, I was born in New York State. For the first 10 years of my life, I lived in Williamsville. That's a small suburb of Buffalo. Out there, they call these things villages, of about 7,500 people, and then moved to a very small village of less than 1,000 people, about 8 miles outside of Jamestown, which is the last city about as far west of New York City as you can go and still be in the state of New York. Jamestown itself neatly encapsulates what's happening in New York State as New York City bleeds the rest of the state dry. Jamestown, like other cities in New York, was faced with crippling taxes and regulations, and it began bleeding its industries. Now, unlike Oregon's rural areas, these are not cities and counties dependent on logging or ranching. Instead, these were major manufacturing areas. Kodak, Xerox, General Electric, Westinghouse all had major plants in upstate New York in places like Rochester and Syracuse and Buffalo. Jamestown was world-renowned for its furniture, until the company packed up and moved to North Carolina, a state with lower taxes. Typical of big government, after bleeding industries, rather than cut services, Jamestown pushed the tax burden onto its remaining citizens, and then it began to bleed population. In the span of about 20 years, it lost 25% of its population. According to an article by our guest today, William Tucker, Jamestown now has the rather dubious distinction of being the city with the lowest percentage of college graduates in America. What happened in Jamestown has happened time and again in other cities in upstate New York. Sadly, this will be the future of Oregon's more rural areas if we don't stop this. And then in the second half of our show, we'll talk with U.S. Congressman Tom McClintock out of Northern California to talk about the environmental devastation that happens when urban cities control what rural areas can and can't do with their own land, a policy situation Oregon is all too familiar with, so stay tuned for that. I'd like to welcome now William Tucker. He's a contributor to the American Media Institute and has written for Harper's, Reader's Digest, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times Magazine. He is the author of Terrestrial Energy, and he's joining us now by phone. Bill, it's good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
So I'd kind of like to set the stage in this opening segment here about what is the economic devastation that has and is occurring in New York State. And you have a great article out there, and we'll make sure that we link it up on iSpyRadio.com. It's called How High Taxes and Regulation Are Killing One of the Most Prosperous States in the Nation, published by Deseret News. And in that, you talk about the devastation that New York City routinely unleashes on the rest of the state in terms of political, regulatory, and tax burdens. So the big question, I think, is why? Why do they continue to do this, and why don't they see the effect of their own policies on the rest of the state?
Yeah. Well, I think what I hear over and over is that the politicians say, think mainly in terms of New York City. And they just say, look, this is a world capital. This is the biggest city in the world. We've got to, people have to be here. It's a commercial necessity. And so it doesn't really matter how high we tax them or how much we regulate them, because they're going to stay here anyway. They're going to be in New York anyway. Now, that may work for New York City, but the thing is, when you apply that same logic to a city like Rochester or Buffalo or Syracuse, it's just devastating. Mm. The high taxes just drive businesses out, and the regulation is impossible to deal with. And those cities just can't compete. You know, they're just they're secondary thought in the minds of the politicians, and it doesn't do any, doesn't register.
No, unfortunately it doesn't and hasn't for quite some time. I mentioned in the opener there about my own experience having grown up in New York State and having seen this firsthand. But talk to us about some of the devastation that has already occurred as a result of this New York City first approach in terms of the businesses leaving and the people leaving.
Well, Rochester used to be one of the most creative, productive cities in the country. They've had Xerox. They started Xerox there. They started Kodak. They started Bausch & Lomb. And all those companies have now pretty much left. Kodak still has a small presence. But the reason is they just, they couldn't cope with the taxes. And the same happened with Syracuse. They used to have Carrier air conditioning there. And they moved a couple of years ago, the whole operation down south. Unionization has a lot to do with it in the instance of Carrier. But those cities are, Rochester and Buffalo are now the fifth and sixth poorest cities in the nation. And they go into this downward spiral where you get a more and more of a welfare population, and they more and more government services, fewer and fewer people working. And the tax burden just becomes impossible. Now, in New York State, you have one condition that no other state has, and that is that the city governments and county governments must pay for Medicaid. And this was a typical New York thing. When Medicaid was started, they were going to match. They a 50-50 match with the state spending. Now, most states thought of, well, how can we keep spending down? But New York, they said, oh boy, this is a great opportunity to leverage. We're going to leverage federal funds here. And they decided to spend as much as they possibly could on Medicaid. In order to do this, they decided to have the counties and the cities would contribute as well. So what's happened is New York spends more on Medicaid than Texas and California combined.
Wow.
Even though those two states have a larger population than either. Both of them have larger populations than New York now. And, in New York City, you've almost got, you're within about 10,000, 8,000 people of, you almost have more Medicaid recipients than you have taxpayers.
Wow. And you mentioned that in your article there, and you actually cite he's the executive for Erie County, and he said their entire budget, all of their property taxes go right to Medicaid. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more in terms of what's coming up for Oregon if we don't change our own ways. Stay with us.
Stay informed. News, information, and all our past shows are available on iSpyRadio.com.
And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about New York, using that as an example of what's coming to Oregon if we don't change our way. This is all really a battle of the rural versus urban. And to do all of that, we're talking with William Tucker. He's a contributor to the American Media Institute, has written for places like Harper's, Reader's Digest, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times Magazine. And his one of his more recent articles, which is up on iSpyRadio.com, was published through Deseret News, and it's called How High Taxes and Regulation Are Killing One of the Most Prosperous States in the Nation. And so one of the things that we didn't talk about in that opening segment was the mass exodus of people leaving New York State. Give our audience a sense of how many people are just jumping ship.
Well, I think in the past decade, New York has lost 500,000 people, mostly from upstate. The population is not, the whole state's population is somewhat stabilized by the huge influx of immigrants into New York City. I mean, 40% of the people in New York City were not born in this country. And you do get a huge surge there. It's not as all bad. I mean, a lot of those people are very entrepreneurial, and they've been quite successful. But as far as upstate is concerned, it's just a mass exodus, and people are leaving for other parts of the country. All lower tax states and warmer weather usually do it.
So in terms of looking at some of these taxes and policies to get a sense of what's coming to states like Oregon, if we can't find a solution here, you mentioned in that article that states generally have three potential sources of revenue: the income tax, the sales tax, and property tax, and that usually a state is going to concentrate on one of those and then go low on the other two. A prime example is Washington State has a sales tax but no income tax. Here we have an income tax but no sales tax. So, but New York State, however, is wildly different. Having grown up there, it is just it's like a Russian nesting dolls of taxes. You've got layer upon layer of taxes because they have layer upon layer of governments. Out here, we have state and county. One of my brothers lives in a small village out there, but he pays property taxes to the village, the township, which is kind of like a county within a county, and then the county. And on top of that, he then pays school taxes, income taxes, and sales tax. And so when I hear about somebody here in Oregon saying, oh, well, we ought to consider adding a sales tax to help level out things, I shudder when I hear people say that.
Yeah, I think the states do best when they just concentrate on one form of taxation and lowball on the other two. And that's the pattern. That's the most common pattern around the country. You can in the states that have very high, that have no income tax, do have very high sales taxes. And but it's in, I mean, New York, they do all, it's all three. They're in the top five, I think, of on all three forms of taxation. And then you got the business tax on top of that, and unincorporated business taxes, and it's just endless.
It is endless, and I did a little research on that point beforehand, and it says New York State has 62 counties, which are subdivided into 932 towns and 62 cities. It also has 10 Indian reservations. In total, the state has over 3,400 active local governments and over 4,200 taxing jurisdictions. And so I know that one of my first lessons in economics and competition as a kid was we had five kids in the family, and so when it came time for school shopping, we drove 30 miles to Erie, PA to save on sales tax. So don't you see that a lot, too, happening within New York State? And I know that the Indian reservations, that was always a big one.
Well, that's a, Indian reservations don't pay any taxes, and they've become the economic powerhouses of upstate New York. Oh, they have cigarette taxes, that's the other thing. There's always a huge battle as to whether they have to pay cigarette taxes. And, of course, then they smuggle the Indian brands down to, into the cities, and people sell them on the street corners. And I know a couple of, you know, small newspaper stores that just as soon as that cigarette tax went, their business just went downhill because people stopped buying cigarettes. I mean, I think it's $12 a pack now or something.
Oh, it's astronomical. And you'll do anything really to avoid those taxes. Like I said, not only do you save on sales tax by going there, but then also you don't have to pay the gas tax and some of the other taxes that they level on.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. Coming back, we'll be talking about some of the solutions, hopefully, that are out there. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show talking about urban versus rural today. And no greater example of that probably than New York State, although we're seeing a lot of that creeping into Oregon here. And we are talking with veteran journalist William Tucker. He's a contributor to the American Media Institute and has written for Reader's Digest, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times, just to name a few. And we'll link up some of his articles on iSpyRadio.com. And so before we leave you, we want to talk to you about possibly some solutions. What can the people, especially in the rural areas, do? Because the situation in New York is similar to what we face here in Oregon, which is you have this giant black hole of population that sucks in all of the dollars, but also because that population center, they essentially can outweigh and outvote the rest of the state. And so it's kind of, you're kind of left with this situation of, you know, what can we possibly do? Before we get there, though, in terms of the problems that New York State faces, where you've got all of that money heading to the one large population base, is that similar to what we see in places like Illinois and Michigan that also have that one single really large population base, or are these unique to New York?
Yeah, I think Illinois is going to be the next state to go, because Chicago is in much worse. I mean, New York City is actually in fairly decent shape because they had that brush with bankruptcy, and they've straightened out their finances since then, but Chicago has all these pension commitments that it's never going to be able to meet. And I don't know, who knows what's going to happen. The state is going to have to step in, but of course, they're going to have a tough time affording it as well.
So in the situations where you've got a state where that one population base can outvote the rest of the state, what really can the rural areas do? And have you ever seen examples of the rural areas and the urban areas working together to change things around?
The place where it works is when you have referendums, statewide referendums of limiting taxation. I think that's the place where you really because when it comes to taxation, urban people are just as upset as rural people. And you get a consensus, and I think that the states that held those anti-tax referendum in the 1970s and 80s have really made a difference. Like Massachusetts had a Proposition 2.5 where they limited the property tax to 2.5%, and they've survived. I mean, they have a lot of the same instincts as New York State in terms of taxation and the growth of government, but it's funny that we read about those populist rebellions of the early 20th century when you had popular election of senators and then you had initiative referendum and recall, and it really made a difference because New York didn't get any of those, and you don't have public initiatives in New York State. It's very, there's no popular government pushing against the legislature.
Well, and that was actually a real surprise when I moved from New York to Oregon, is that the voters could actually decide on some of these measures. That was kind of shocking. But unfortunately, the way that the legislators have worked it out here is they slap an emergency clause on everything that prevents it from going to the voters. So in terms of it getting better, do you find that it often has to get worse before it can get better?
Well, probably so, yeah. But, it's funny. I think the other place where Oregon is very similar to New York is in this business of, in New York, it's the fracking that they're not allowing.
Yeah.
And in Oregon, you have the lumber industry that was heavily closed down by the environmental concerns.
We'd like to say Nazis.
I'm sorry?
I said we like to say Nazis, the environmental Nazis.
Right. But, you're still pretty much closed down, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah, very much. The rural areas are starving. They actually have counties that are on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you see that in western New York.
Yes.
With in the southern tier there, where they're right across the border from Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania's allowed fracking. They're just prospering on that side of the border. And New York State is, I talk with this one woman who's running a campaign against, in favor of fracking, and she was saying how people out in western New York now are cutting down trees for firewood because they can't afford the gas and oil bills anymore. Rural poverty.
How
they call it Appalachian North there.
Yeah, well, and that's a pretty good descriptor. Unfortunately, we are up against the time here with you. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, sure. Anytime.
And coming up, U.S. Congressman Tom McClintock on the environmental devastation these policies cause. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, and we've been talking about the ongoing battle between urban versus rural. We just wrapped up with William Tucker about the economic devastation New York City has unleashed on the rest of New York State. Now we'd like to turn our attention to another kind of devastation urban areas put on rural areas, environmental policies. People in cities deciding what's best for these kinds of situations rather than people closest to the land actually making those decisions. Next to Oregon, there's probably no finer example of the kind of a devastation this can cause on rural areas than in rural California. And to talk about that, I'd like to welcome Congressman Tom McClintock from the 4th Congressional District out of California. It runs east from the Sacramento suburbs to the Nevada border and southeast, including mountainous regions and the Yosemite National Park. Congressman McClintock, welcome back. It's good to talk to you again.
It's good to be back, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So one of the big pieces of news that led us to you was your newsletter, I think it was on April 4th, talking about the devastation right now that's happening in California. Talk to us what it's like to be there living in California with that massive water shortage you guys have going on.
Well, the hydrologists are telling us this is the worst drought in 1,200 years. You have to go back to 800 AD to find a drier period in our region's history. The rainy season's now officially over. Our snowpack, which holds so much of our water for the summer months, is at only 3% of normal. There's practically nothing there. And our reservoirs, which ought to be brim full right now, are between a third and a quarter of their capacity. So New Melones, for example, is at 22% of its capacity. It ought to be brim full right now. And yet, because of the environmental laws that have prevented us from building new dams for the past 30 years so that we have enough water from the wet years in order to carry over into dry years like this, the precious little water that we have remaining behind our dams is being drained for environmental purposes. We have just seen a 30,000 acre foot pulse flow, actually two pulse flows, 30,000 acre feet. That's about 10 billion gallons of water. That's enough for the annual needs of a residential population of about 300,000 people. That amount of water was released in 2 weeks in April in order to benefit the offspring of 29 steelhead trout to encourage them to swim toward the ocean, which, by the way, they generally tend to do without our help, and almost all of whom get eaten before they get to the ocean by predators, many of them non-native. Let's say that those several hundred smolt actually would not have swum to the river without our helpful assistance and would have been given safe passage by all of the predatory fish on their way. That amount of enough water to meet the annual needs of 300,000 human beings was sacrificed in the process. That's the extreme to which our environmental laws have now been taken. You know, I think it was Eric Hoffer said that that every great cause becomes a movement that becomes a business that becomes a racket, and we've now entered that final stage with our extreme environmental laws.
Oh wow, 300,000 people down the toilet to save what would you say 29 fish?
Well, the offspring of 29 fish. Yeah.
Wow.
And you know, bear in mind, this is going on all throughout the West. Folsom Lake, which serves the Sacramento area, is seeing a big release of water right now to adjust water temperatures for the fish. Meanwhile, by the way, our forest, you mentioned I have the Sierra Nevada, is most of my district is Sierra Nevada. We start up in Truckee north of Lake Tahoe and go all the way south through Yosemite Valley, through Kings Canyon, all the way to Fresno County. We have seen absolutely devastating fires now, predating, by the way, the drought. But we've had two major ones, one last year, the King Fire, the year before that, the Rim Fire, which was the biggest fire in the history of the Sierra Nevada, 400 square miles destroyed because we've consigned our forests to a policy of benign neglect under these same environmental laws. We've seen an 80% decline in the timber harvest out of the forests during this period. And as you know, Forrester once pointed out, you know, all that excess timber will come out of the forest one way or another.
Yeah.
It will either be carried out or it will be burned out. But it comes out. When we carried it out, we had much healthier forests and we had a thriving economy. And since we consigned our forests to a policy of benign neglect, we've seen increasingly devastating and intense fires. And by the way, an absolutely crippled local economy.
Just absolutely devastating. I guess the only thing that makes me feel better is that even as bad as things are here in Oregon, apparently California can do worse.
Well, again, these are national policies, so they'll be affecting. They're compounded by bad state policies.
Yes.
I mentioned I have Lake Tahoe in my district. I had a visit from a group of Tahoe business people about a year ago, and I asked them, well, you know, what's it like doing business in a community that's divided between two states? And one of them immediately chimed in and said, well, it's very simple. On the Nevada side, they ask, how can we help you? On the Nevada, or on the California side, they ask, how can we stop you?
Wow.
So you've got bad public policy in California compounding bad federal policy, but the federal policy is what's driving a lot of the water releases, as well as the fact we've not built a major dam since 1979 in California. By major, I mean holding more than 1 million acre feet of water. Meanwhile, the population's nearly doubled. And droughts are nature's fault. They happen. Water shortages are our fault. We've not kept pace with our water needs, despite the fact we have immense water resources in California. I mean, everybody thinks the Colorado is the big river in the West. The Colorado River is junior to the Sacramento. Sacramento is much bigger. The difference is we store 70 million acre feet of water on the Colorado. We only store 10 million acre feet on the Sacramento. We lose most of the rest of that to the Pacific Ocean every year. So we're not going to solve our water shortage until we begin building more dams, and we're not going to build more dams until we overhaul the radical environmental regulations that are making their construction impossible. I've got a little community called Forest Hill, just a few thousand people. Their water supply is a small lake called the Sugar Pine Reservoir. It was created by a small dam in the early 1980s. The dam was built with an 18-foot spillway, but no spillway gate because they didn't need the extra water. They do now. So they recently went out and priced what's it going to cost to install that spillway gate and raise the elevation of the lake by 18 feet. And the answer is $2 million to actually create and transport and install the gate. But that's not the price of the project. They have to add at least $1 million on for environmental reviews and at least $2 million on top of that for environmental mitigation. Mm. So a $2 million project that was a heavy lift for that little community, but possible, becomes a $5 million boondoggle. And that's the story of our dams across the western United States.
Wow, absolutely stunning stuff. All right, we have just gotten started with Representative Tom McClintock. Stay with us. We'll have more on the battle between rural and urban areas. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. Today, it's all about the rural versus the urban areas. To talk about all that, we're talking with Congressman Tom McClintock from the 4th Congressional District of California. That's in the northern part of the state. It takes in both urban and rural areas, including the Sacramento suburbs, over to the Nevada border and southeast down through the Sierra Nevada mountains. And in that previous segment, you mentioned that they flush down enough water for the annual needs for a city the size of 300,000 people. Yeah, that alone, and that was to save the offspring of 29 salmon.
Steelhead
trout. And I got to tell you, that is shocking enough, but I'm just real curious what you heard from your constituents when that happened. Are they supporting doing that thing?
I was beating the drums on this last year when we had these massive pulse flows, and nobody paid any attention. And it slowly began to occur to me the reason that I'm not seeing this firestorm of protest is nobody believes me. Mm. Nobody actually believes that our policy could be so stupid as in the middle of an historic drought to release what little water we have remaining behind our dams for the fish when it's desperately needed by the human population. Well, we had enough water then behind the dams. I guess people really weren't focused on it. Now they're watching their dams reach empty. And that is, I think, focusing the public's attention. I think it was Dr. Samuel Johnson who once said that when a man is to be hanged in the morning, it concentrates his attention remarkably. And I think as our reservoirs near empty and these idiotic pulse flows for the fish continue, people are beginning to realize that this is coming with a very steep price.
And just to be clear, when you say nobody believes you, are you talking about your constituents or your fellow congressmen?
Yeah, I was expecting the public would just be up in arms about this, and it was crickets out there. This year is something different, though. This year, as the reservoirs reach empty, I think the key point was the Bureau of Reclamation threatened to drain Tulloch Lake, which is a smaller reservoir just downstream from New Malonis, basically to the mud line. That would have taken the water level below the intake pipes that serve a community of 10,000 people. And in fact, it got so bad that the local water district, as the Bureau of Reclamation was releasing water, diverted it into a holding area and said, wait a second, it was civil disobedience. And that worked out a scheduling arrangement which should hopefully stretch the remaining water behind New Malonis into the fall. Otherwise, their pulse flows would have exhausted the water about midsummer, and that would have devastated the community of Copperopolis and about 10,000 people that live there and in the adjoining communities that directly depend upon those water intakes for their water supply.
Well, in terms of, getting back to this notion that nobody believes you or believed you last year when you were talking about this, and now here they're seeing these millions of gallons just being flushed down the toilet,
billions.
Essentially.
Billions.
That's right, billions. So potentially this could be a good thing if it starts finally waking people up to start correcting some of this nonsense. Would you agree?
Well. But at what cost? The cost of this newfound public engagement is we'll have run out of water.
Yeah.
Again, at this point, with the schedule, at least on New Malonis, that they've agreed to, we may be able to stretch our water supply to the end of the summer dry period. But if the rains don't return in the fall, that's when we're really going to see the damage of these policies, because that's when communities across California are going to start turning on their water faucets and nothing's going to come out.
So in terms of the people making these decisions,
then they'll be able to look at these releases and realize, that was the water that we sent down these rivers of last spring is the water they now no longer have to put in their water glasses and their sinks.
But do you think the people will connect those dots, though? I mean, will they just say, this is just because it's a drought? Or do you think they will actually say, oh, wait a minute, we had the water, we flushed it down the toilet in order to save some fish?
Everywhere I go, people are very much aware of this. And actually, it was, I'm kind of simplifying. It was actually two pulse flows. The first pulse flow was for the population of 29. That was 15,000 acre feet. The second pulse flow was for a population of 6.
Wow.
And people are very much aware of those 6 fish that had all of that water spent on them.
And in terms of the people that are making these policy decisions, let's go ahead and waste all the 300,000 people. I guess they just don't need it. What do they think those people are going to do now?
You're asking me to read minds read the minds of people who are completely out of their minds. I don't know. I don't know what could possibly possess somebody to release that kind of water, that kind of amount of water in a historic drought, because they wanted to nudge some smolts to swim toward the ocean. I don't get that, but there it is.
So in terms of fish versus people, what is Congress's
fish
perception?
Are winning.
Yeah, really. Obviously. What is Congress's perception back in Washington of this action, and are there any plans to try to stop this?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, the House just passed the Energy and Water Appropriation Act, which is the funding act for all water and energy issues. It approved my amendment to forbid the Bureau of Reclamation from buying water for the purpose of environmental flows. Just to put a price tag on the 30,000 acre feet they released out of New Malonis at $700 an acre foot, that's $21 million. So, we've got the worst of both worlds, where our tax money is being used to buy up this water, and then it is literally poured down the drain before our eyes, while, by the way, all of us are being threatened with draconian fines if we take too long in the shower or spill a gallon of water on our sidewalks. while the government that is issuing these threats is happily squandering billions of gallons of water for the fish. So the measure that passed the House forbids the use of tax money to buy up water for these environmental releases this year. That passed, but I have to also tell you it passed on a near party line vote. I think only two Democrats came over to join Republicans on that.
Wow.
And then the Democrats in the House put forth a motion that failed that would have appropriated, I believe, another $13 million to continue this practice. So, you know, at some point, you know, the public's going to have to weigh in on this and say, okay, what direction do we want to take as a people?
Well, and the two Democrats, were they from California?
Yeah, both from very vulnerable districts. Jim Costa, who won his last re-election by just a handful of votes, and Scott Peterson from San Diego, who was also in a very close election.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's clear they know where the people are because the Democrats who are the most vulnerable crossed party lines and voted with us. So you know, there's obviously a realization they're voting against the people on this, but they do it anyway. And I don't know whether that's just because the environmental movement is so strong within the Democratic Party or whether these people are just out of their minds. But whatever it is, it's creating some very bad public policy.
Yeah, neither one is a good combination. All right, let's take our break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Congressman McClintock talking about the urban versus rural battle. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show and our final segment now with Congressman Tom McClintock. And on today's show, it's all been about urban versus rural, that city versus country. And Congressman, you had mentioned something in the last segment that I want to come back to. You mentioned the notion of buying water. You're going to prohibit that from happening. What exactly does that mean? Where are you guys buying it from?
Buy it from the holders of those rights. You know, some of the water is you know, held in federal dams and is federal water. Others of it is held behind those dams for various owners, and the water is purchased from the owners and then dumped down the drain. And so it's our tax money being used against us.
So let's talk now a little bit about the farmers. How are they going to handle this drought? What are they looking at here?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Central Valley farmers were cut back long before the drought because of immense diversions of water out to the Pacific Ocean that had been promised to them that they had actually purchased, were instead, under the environmental laws, diverted to the Pacific Ocean to make the fish happy. You've heard the controversies over the Delta smelt, for example, a 3-inch minnow that caused about a quarter million acres of the most fertile farmland in America in the Central Valley to be fallowed for lack of water. We've now lost about a half a million acres of crops for that very reason. That has huge implications to the economy as well as to the to, you know, our food prices.
Oh, absolutely. And so here are these farmers that are basically having their land devastated in front of them. You know, we just talked about the concept of buying water, and so now you're going to have another further economic devastation as these farmers are faced with, you know, basically no crops, no economic activity.
And one thing we have to do is stop thinking about, that's agricultural water, that's not residential water. Well, an average person uses about 100 to 200 gallons of water a day in their home, you know, for washing, watering the lawn, that's, you know, the dishwasher, laundry machine, all of that. But we actually consume far more water than that. When we sit down to order a cheeseburger, for example,
sure,
about 750 gallons of water went into growing the stuff that's in the cheeseburger that you have for lunch. Go to the mall and buy a pair of jeans. Those jeans represent about 1,800 gallons of water that you just consumed in order to grow the cotton that's in the jeans. So, you know, when we talk about cutting back on agricultural water, we're really talking about cutting back on all the stuff that you and I consume every day that's part of our water consumption, even though we don't see it directly.
Yeah, good points. And in terms of people getting that, though? Again, today's whole show has been about this notion of urban versus rural, and I just don't think most of the people that live in cities really have a real concept in terms of, you know, you just mentioned the water usage, but in terms of so many other issues like the agriculture and the timber and mining and all of these other issues, how do we start waking them up to what we need to in order to be able, for people in rural areas to be able to survive?
Well, again, the people in the rural areas live with these decisions every day. You know, I mentioned the devastated economies because of heavy cutbacks of timber that have not only devastated the economies, but have also crippled the ecology of the forest. The forests are now horribly overgrown. They're becoming a prey not only to intense catastrophic fires, but also to disease and pestilence.
Mm-hmm.
We used to thin out these forests. Now these trees are stressed to the max, fighting for the same ground with five other trees because we stopped thinning them out. So, you know, our folks see that. They feel the economic effects. You know, as we close the public lands to more and more human recreation, they see that in the decline in their tourist dollars. They live these things every day. But you know, when you get to something like water policy, I think even urban populations are going to very rapidly begin to feel the effects of this kind of squandering of water through the pulse flows for the fish, as well as the fact that we've not built a major dam in this state since 1979, while the population of the state's nearly doubled.
You know, but again, it comes back to, will people connect the dots that they need to, and not just that there's no water because of the environmental policies, but the people that are pushing these through are these environmental organizations that are out there pushing these kinds of things. But then it's
those organizations do not represent a lot of people. They represent themselves. The people have often elected officials to agree with them.
Right.
But the public itself, I think, is coming from a very different place these days. The public today is realizing the impact of these policies and the negative consequences it has for the economy and for their quality of life. And that's why I think you're seeing the big change in American politics that we're watching.
Well, and see, that's the thing, is it's going to come down to, will they stop electing Democrats that push these kinds of policies? But I mean, you mentioned two Democrats there within California that woke up to this. How do we start changing the minds of the Democrats that are out there? I mean, the elected officials.
Remember what Everett Dirksen said: when they feel the heat, they see the light. I think the population, as they become up to speed on these issues, realizing the impact of these policies, holding their elected officials accountable for the votes that they've cast on these policies, I think that Congress is, again, we've already seen a major shift, the biggest Republican majorities in the House and the Senate that any time since 1928. There's something huge going on out there.
Well, and that's good. That's encouraging. Real quick, we got two questions for you in about a minute and a half to do it in. The most recent bill that you talked about that did pass the House, I assume that's going to pass the Senate. What about the prospects once it gets to the president?
Well, it's an appropriations bill. So if the president vetoes that bill, he'll be shutting down all of our energy and water programs. That's going to be very hard to explain.
Okay. And then in terms of the new Congress, what's the biggest difference you've seen now that the Republicans have the majority in the House and the Senate? Do you feel the Congress is finally getting back to work?
The Senate is functioning again. Now, it functions very slowly. Remember what Jefferson said. It's the saucer in which the hot tea of the House is left to cool. But it is functioning. You know, it requires six Democrats to cross party lines just to bring up a bill in the Senate. It took the House one day to pass the Keystone Pipeline bill. It took the Senate 2 months to pass that same bill, but it's functioning again. It was not doing so under Harry Reid.
No.
The House passed four balanced budgets to the Senate over the last 4 years. The Senate just sat there. Now we have a balanced budget that should be enacted today by the Senate after the House has acted. So as of today, we should have the first balanced budget since 2001.
Wow. Well, unfortunately, we are up against the clock, but that's good news to end on.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. And thank you for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show. You know, there are very few things that get me so riled up as this urban versus rural debate, and especially when it comes to environmental issues, people that live in these big cities trying to tell rural areas how to live their lives when they just don't have a real clue in terms of the devastation that they're doing. If there is an event coming up in June that we have up on iSpyRadio.com. You can find the event there. It's called Rally Around the Flag. This is a great opportunity for people to come in and get involved, start networking with other people that are also experiencing these issues, and let's start turning things around here in Oregon. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.